When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Techno Roll, a special Let It Roll maxi series discussing Michelangelo Matos's book, The Underground is Massive: How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America, hosted by Nate Wilcox and Ryan Harkness. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ryan talk about the 2011 Electric Daisy Carnival, EDM's run atop the pop charts, and the rise of dubstep. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll, or shall I say Techno Roll. That's right, I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, joined once again by Ryan Harkness to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. And this week, Ryan, it's going to conquer America.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this chapter. I honestly feel like there should have been just a book that was 2010 onwards, because everything is just mashed into this chapter, and you could spend four or five chapters on this alone. And we've broken out multiple parts of this story into our own chapters from other books and stuff like that, like all the dubstep stuff, right up until it turns into bro step, we've covered before. So anybody who really wants a deep dive into that, we've got like two dubstep episodes already out there somewhere.
Yep. From the Simon Reynolds series. And the topic, or the party of this week's episode, is the Electric Daisy Carnival from Las Vegas, Nevada, June 24th to 26th, 2011. But we don't start at 2011. We start in 2007 with the Electric Daisy Carnival at LA Coliseum in June of 2007. And this is Pasquale Rotella's event. We've heard from him many times in this book. Although Matos also brings back another character from the past, from previous chapters, in Gary Richards, who had actually named the Electric Daisy Carnival way back in like 91 or 92 when he was co-promoting parties with Rotella and others. But Rotella had taken it and run with it. Richards at this point hadn't promoted a party in like 15 years, I think was the number they threw out there.
Yeah, something like that.
And Rotella's got the Electric Daisy Carnival, and he's also got the Nocturnal Wonderland. That's his main event. That was being promoted at the Empire Polo Grounds. And that drew 40,000 people in 2007. And he hired Bunny from Rabbit in the Moon as the creative director in 2008. Also hired Velo Verkhaus, who did the projection mapping and computer graphics for Rabbit in the Moon. And so really upped the show at both Electric Daisy Carnival and Nocturnal Wonderland. In 2009, he expanded Electric Daisy Carnival to two nights. And in 2010, he expanded it to Denver, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Dallas, as well as Los Angeles.
Yeah, this is kind of where Insomniac goes from being your typical rave or massive promoter into like a next level entity that's doing things that have never really been done before in North America. And it really shapes the future of the scene, both in North America and worldwide.
Yeah, and his success gets Gary Richards intrigued. And he comes back into promotion in 2007, in December of 2007, with the Hard event, and he books Steve Aoki, Peaches, and Justice. So the way that's described is kind of a diss on the music that Rotella was picking for EDC up to that point, and that Richards is updating it with Aoki, who's kind of become the king of the LA post-electroclash scene. Is that a good way to describe it?
Well, I mean, just kind of the celebro electro sound.
There you go. And also Peaches coming straight out of the New York electro clash scene. And then Justice, who's I want to call proto brostep, but that's not really fair, is it?
Yeah, no, Justice really just took that French touch, like French electro sound, and turned it up to 11, added in a whole bunch of like glam rock to it. And yeah, just kind of set the, because when you're talking about brostep and you're talking about dubstep, electro and brostep have more in common with each other than is usually kind of acknowledged. When you listen to that first Skrillex EP, My Name is Skrillex, those tracks aren't even really trying to be dubstep. They're more electro, but the wobble just kind of steps in. And once the wobble takes over, it leans more into brostep than it does electro. But I mean, they're right mashed together. This era is all about how the dubstep wobble infected electro and basically turned into these big room EDM bangers.
And EDM also infects the pop charts in this time. And Matos does sort of a run through of how, quote, pop radio sounded more and more like a vintage anthems compilation with some reality TV stars sprinkled on top. Reality TV stars sprinkled on top. That's kind of harsh on Rihanna and Pitbull, don't you think?
Well, I mean, all these songs ended up on the soundtrack for Jersey Shore and basically everything else that was on MTV. This was when MTV basically completely abandoned the music video and switched over to reality television. And this music was kind of the soundtrack for all of that garbage.
Ah, I see that. Got to tag you for the value judgment there with the garbage comment. But this stuff was big. It was unavoidable. He shouts out Rihanna's SOS from 2006, which was electro and based on Soft Cell's classic Tainted Love synth pop hit from the early 80s, which in turn was a cover of an old Northern Soul song from the 60s. Also, Rihanna had good luck with We Found Love, partnered with Calvin Harris. That went to number one in 2012. This era kind of kicks off with Black Eyed Peas' I Got a Feeling in 2009, produced by David Guetta, becomes the biggest selling song in iTunes history. Then you also get Pitbull featuring Nia, Nayer, and Afrojack, Give Me Everything, number one in 2011. And then you've got LMFAO, the grandsons of Berry Gordy of Motown fame, with Party Rock Anthem and Sexy and I Know It with 2011. Matos shouts out the epic trance synths a la the late 90s all over those tracks. And then Britney Spears also had Till the World Ends, and Rihanna had Only Girl in the World. So yeah, it's just like all of a sudden all these pop performers switched up their backgrounds to be EDM. Clear sea change.
There was definitely like this period of time where all of a sudden it's more acceptable for pop artists to just go out and collaborate and find collaborators that they're interested in working with. It's not always studio led, and guys like David Guetta and Afrojack all wanted in on this thing and found artists that were willing to work with them. And the tracks that came out were just massive, massive success because this is the first time. They kind of mentioned this a bit later in the chapter, how David Guetta was trying to get his American label to pay attention to him and do stuff. And they're like, you know, there's no market for anything. They refused to come to Electric Daisy Carnival because they were just like, oh, what's the point? And he's like, well, there's 100,000 people here. So these are these artists kind of like taking the bull by the horns and pushing their music into the mainstream, where it's finally kind of front and center. And America is just ready for it. They're primed and the new sound just takes off.
Yeah, absolutely. And Diplo is one producer that Matos gives a shout out. That's Thomas Wesley Pence, who Matos says managed to balance commercial success and critical acclaim. He produces the first two MIA albums, and Matos gives her real name, which I'd never seen before, Maya Arul Pragazam, which is quite the mouthful. Paper Planes by MIA went to number four in 2008, produced by Diplo. And then you had Upon the Floor by Major Lazer with Vybz Kartel. And Major Lazer is Diplo plus UK producer Switch, whose real name is Dave Taylor. And this Upon the Floor becomes the basis for Beyonce's Girls Run the World. And then Diplo also had success partnering with Afrojack for Chris Brown's Look at Me Now, featuring Lil Wayne and Busta Rhymes, which goes to number 6 in 2011. So, yeah, just a glorious era of pop hits. And let's go ahead and hear our first track. This is Benny the Third versus DJ Dinesh, London. And that was Benny the Third versus DJ Dinesh, London. Why'd you pick this one?
Well, we're just about to get into UK dubstep. There was so much to jam in here into this episode. I decided I didn't want to even really touch on the Americanized dubstep because we don't know what it sounds like. But, you know, to jump back to 2003 to 2006, I figured people might want a bit of a taste of what original UK dubstep sounded like so they can put themselves kind of in the headspace for this next segment where we discuss where American dubstep kind of was birthed out of.
And that happens to be a radio show, The Dubstep Wars, broadcast January 10th, 2006. Marianne Hobbs, a BBC programmer, dropped this show. She interviewed multiple DJs from Croydon, which was the hotbed of dubstep in South London. Steve Goodman, aka Code 9, was of the Hyperdub label, was a guest on the show. And they just kind of ran through a history of dubstep, which, as we talked about during the Simon Reynolds series, comes out of the UK garage two-step thing. Grime, the hip-hop variant from London, is in the mix, and then that evolved into dubstep. Croydon's Big Apple record store was the hub, and then Hatcha, aka Terry Leonard, clerked there, and also DJed Thursdays at the Velvet Room at FWD, and then the Tempa All-Stars Volume 1 inspired a ton of DJs. Matos mentions Jack Dunning, aka Untold, who switched from jungle to dubstep, or drum and bass from dubstep. And then this Dubstep Wars show is so big that the Dubstep Forum triples its membership in short order after it airs. And this is just one of those moments where I guess a massive American audience heard about the UK dubstep scene, which frankly had been pretty obscure. This is a really unusual genre, and that it goes from this artsy backwater to frat boy, bro town, massive, massive success. It's really strange. And then we talk about Burial, aka Will Bevan, who had submitted demos to Steve Goodman, aka Code 9, for the Hyperdub zine. Goodman ended up signing Burial to Hyperdub Records. And then Untrue, the 2007 Burial's second album, gets nominated for the Mercury Prize, makes Pitchfork's annual top 10 list. And that's, you know, after the Dubstep Wars show. And so it's part of dubstep building up this head of steam. And one of the reasons the dubstep was so successful in this period is it had a consistent 140 beats per minute tempo that if you tweaked the drums, you could glue multiple styles together in a set. So if you varied the drum programming, you can have a tune that bumps along like deep house, or you can give it some garage swagger, or even match the pace of drum and bass. So it kind of becomes the ultimate alchemy style there for a minute, and that DJs, it's very convenient for DJs to mix in different styles. Were you able to mix it into your blend as a DJ?
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely true. 140 beats per minute was that magic number where you can pretty much mix this stuff into anything. And it takes me back to the old Rage days with Fabio and Groove Rider, where they were waiting for breakbeat to kind of catch up to house and techno, and mixing it all together. And this dubstep stuff could kind of come in anywhere, and it was great opening set music, and it just kind of continued to grow in intensity as that feedback happened, where dubstep was getting played out more and more, and people just kind of continued to up the intensity on it, which made it get played more by DJs, which again, just that feedback loop of it just continuing to grow until all of a sudden this weird kind of twitchy, glitchy, down-tempo stuff started wobbling and raving pretty hard.
And it gets support from some of the old timers like Ricardo Villalobos, gets gives prominent play to Scream's Midnight Request line in 2005. Then he remixes Shackleton's Blood on My Hands, and that's a goer. And then in June 2007, Scream plays to a packed house of 8,000 at Barcelona's Sonar Festival. So it's, yeah, it's blowing up. And then he talks about the Dub Police label and Caspa, a.k.a. Gary McCann, and Rusko, a.k.a. Chris Mercer, were the founders of the Dub Police level, started it in 2006. And then tracks like Cockney Thug by Rusko in 2007 and Floridum by Caspa in 2008. That brings in the Wobble in a big way, and it just gets over. He's got some quotes from Vivian Host of the Brooklyn label and Party Trouble and Bass, who said, "People didn't like dubstep for a long time. We would play it at our parties and people would just be like, huh? Until Rusko started releasing tunes." And then in August 2009, the Treble and Bass has their third birthday party and book Binga and Scream, and there's a mosh pit. It was crazy, says Vivian Host. So the New York hipsters have now accepted dubstep. And then he also talks about how it got over in California. John Dadzy, formerly Infiltrata, converts to dubstep from drum and bass. His manager, Danny Johnson, was a driver in that, saw the commercial prospects there, and they cross-promoted to the Steve Aoki crowd. And we started having dubstep guests in 2008. By 2009, we couldn't afford them anymore. That tells you a lot. Like, it just blew up, and the DJ's asking prices were the one of the key measurements.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, you always kind of place a new genre into kind of a room with the other music that kind of sits with, and used to be kind of jungle, drum and bass, breaks all in the same room, and then dubstep kind of was added in there with it. And then dubstep started getting so big that it kind of, dubstep got its own room, and then dubstep started getting their own parties. And then all of a sudden there was just an entire scene, which is just now generally known as the bass scene. So dubstep can just grew from this small seed of being a genre that a DJ might play in a room with a bunch of other stuff to pick in at some of the best talent from all of the other kind of broken beat sounds to just completely taking over in a huge way, and still being now, I'd say, like comparable to, like, maybe not the house scene, but definitely it's its own massive scene with its own group of people, and it just floats along, and people just travel and go to all these bass events now. So that's basically where dubstep ended up.
And then Matos takes a curve in his narrative to rope in some of the stragglers that are going to play a role in this next era. And he stops off at Burning Man, which I guess he hasn't talked about Burning Man up to this point, but because he gives the whole capsule history, how it started at Baker Beach in the Bay Area in 1986, moved to Black Rock Desert in Nevada in 1990. It was basically sort of a hippie fest, rock fest, but it had a raver camp, AKA a raver ghetto. And kind of an unfortunate statement for their status in the scene was, in 1996, two ravers are camping and are run over and killed by somebody from the bigger Burning Man party who drove through the raver camp. But John Kelly's style of desert breaks dominated the rave era, with a little bit of trip hop and turntablism in the mix. But then glitch hop starts being a factor at Burning Man. They cite Preview 73's Vocal Studies and Uprock Narratives album from 2001, kind of introduced the glitch hop thing. And then Bass Nectar, AKA Lauren Ashton, is the pivotal figure who started out making cool bleep bloops to smoke weed to, but then evolved into face melting mid-range bass melodies and catastrophic builds and drops. So Bass Nectar is a big factor in the evolution of dubstep into brostep by way of Burning Man. Is that a fair?
Yeah. I mean, again, like when we're talking about dubstep kind of evolves out of just the restrictions of what dubstep means, even like new dubstep, American dubstep, and just becomes this generalized genre called bass, where you can kind of throw everything in there, all the glitch hop that you want, so long as it's got that big growly bass or the wobble or whatever else like that, then it can sit in that bass family. Like even drum and bass and jungle end up kind of sitting inside bass underneath the umbrella of bass now. And it's when when things got reorganized and Bass became kind of this thing, and Bass Nectar was kind of sitting up at the top until he was revealed to be a sexual creep, as many Bass DJs end up being revealed to be.
Ouch.
I think the reason that Burning Man doesn't get mentioned a lot is because it really isn't affiliated with rave all that much. As they mentioned, there are ravers that go to Burning Man, but there was, considering the fact that there were so many dance stages, rave never really got too deep into Burning Man until bass music kind of came in and started to take over there. And now it's a bit more accepted. You've got a lot of melodic techno stuff going on there as well. A lot of really mature kind of chin scratching, late night booze drinking music going on there as well. But yeah, it's very, very accurate and very apropos that the rave camp was the raver ghetto, and that terrible things happened there to them because it was never really our scene.
Yeah. And listening, you know, to prep for this episode, the bass wobble really strikes me. It's this great mid-range sound that kind of combines the attack of the electric guitar and the attack of scratching on turntables. So it kind of reconnects a lot of things and lets DJs do both rock tricks and hip hop tricks in this new way. But let's hear our next track. This is the Disco Biscuits, Home Again. And that was the Disco Biscuits, Home Again, and perfectly timed for you to segue us into our next bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this chapter is all about trying to thread things that weren't really rave, that were starting to turn into rave things, like Burning Man not really being that ravey or EDM related, but suddenly becoming that with the introduction of bass and some of this newer techno stuff. And then you've got the Disco Biscuits representing kind of the next generation of Phish / Grateful Dead jam bands, and they're integrating rave in there. And the reason I picked that track is because it's so very obviously like a Grateful Dead homage, but with a lot of little bleeps and bloops. So I thought it was a perfect, hilarious kind of introduction to the sound of Jamtronica, as they so dismissively refer to it.
And that is, yeah, pretty much the perfect track. That's exactly what I had imagined Disco Biscuits would sound like, and that definitely satisfies. They started their own festival, Camp Bisco, started in 1999 for 500 people. By 2002, they're bringing in rave staples like Alex Patterson of The Orb, DJ DB, and Scott Hardkiss of the Hardkiss Brothers. And then you know, people like Ben Silver, a.k.a. Orchid Lounge, debut at Camp Bisco in 2003, by which time they're drawing in 5,000 people. And that kickstarts Orchid Lounge career. And then by 2011, they draw almost 20,000 people. In 2013, they scale back and cap the attendance at 13,000, but almost all the acts are EDM. And then they pull the plug on Camp Bisco. I don't know if they've come back into action
since. Yeah, it's back. It's back.
Good to know. And but it's just part of a trend of EDM kind of taking over the jam band circuit. Also, he mentions STS9, the Sound Tribe Sector 9, which is another one of these sort of crusty, spiral tribe-ish sort of Phish, incredible string cheese incident sort of agglomerations. And then he has a little sideline to talk about Molly, which is our old friend MDMA, but has experiencing a second coming in powder form rather than pressed into pills, which the kids for some reason seem to think is better. I guess he had to throw that in there to keep the drug lingo up to date, but it was kind of a
Well, I mean, it's such an important kind of element. It was the book kind of mentions when ecstasy became this big thing. And, you know, as much as maybe some people don't want to admit it, ecstasy was the big driving factor in the Summer of Love with the Acid House in the UK, and a big factor in raves in America, and why the vibe was the way that it was. And Molly was the second coming of ecstasy. And I remember everybody being so much more into it, because with a pressed pill, you never knew what you were going to get. And especially in America, that was bad news, because God knows, like, they could put some really crude, mean stuff in there. So to have a bag of MDMA, which is basically crystallized powder, made everybody feel a lot safer about what they were taking. For some reason, they didn't recognize that there was just as much of an opportunity for shenaniganry in that. But yeah. You know, like to me, I've always been of the opinion that the best way to take ecstasy is in a pill, when it's mixed in with a couple other things, a little upper, a little psychedelic, a little this, a little that. Good pressed pills are a melange of carefully curated things, but obviously that's not always going to be the case. So yeah, Molly just became this sensation, because people were just going around dipping their fingers into these bags of powdered crystal and just either rubbing it up in their gums, or just swallowing it, or parachuting it, putting it in little pieces of paper and turning them into their own little bombs, all sorts of ways to take it. So it was kind of like the fun dip of the drug world for those years.
Well, thank you for that informative. And yeah,
not that I did it a bunch or anything.
Yeah, the stuff's trouble, kids. Stay away. And then he segues over to Seattle, talks about the Decibel Festival. Sean Horton was booking that. It's kind of, he compares it to the MuTech event in Montreal. Says it's MuTech style producer performers at the core. I guess that's opposed to jam bands or performers like Peaches and Spooner Fisher. In 2007, they had the Simian Mobile Disco, which is a spinoff Simian, the indie pop group that had a big EDM hit in collaboration with Justice. And now they, by this point, they had spun off into a purely EDM group, Simian Mobile Disco. Also had Diplo at that show. In 2008, they had the Glitch Mob, and then Deadmau5, aka Joel Zimmerman of Toronto. And he's kind of the reason for this little segment, because this is his first Northwest show in the Pacific Northwest. Plays at 650 people at Numo's on Friday night in 2008. And then they get into Deadmau5, and somebody calls him a case study in really successful branding. That, and then by 2010, he's playing at the Olympics. In 2011, he's the house DJ at the MTV Music Awards. By 2011, his asking price is $100,000 a show. He's playing with Motley Crue's Tommy Lee at the Ultra Music Festival in 2011, plays the House of Blues at Disney World in 2011. And Disney's executives are celebrating, quote, the coolest thing to happen to Mickey Mouse in 40 years, because Deadmau5, of course, wears the giant head. Although it's not strictly Mickey Mouse, it's just a mouse. And Matos contrasts.
Don't you know, Disney owns all mouse related anything now.
Of course, as they should. And Matos contrasts this with their overreaction to early EDM or rave days posters in the early 90s in LA that used Mickey Mouse profanely in many instances. And Disney, you know, of course, chased him after with the cease and desist orders and such like. And then it talks about the Decibel Festival 2009, which featured Benga, Boxcutter, Caspa, Marianne Hobbs, Mala, Martin, N-Type, and Pinch, all dubsteppers, plus Mad Professor for Historical Balance, a great UK reggae producer. The track of the year was Hife Mango by Joy Orbison, a.k.a. Peter O'Grady. And then there's another split. And then this is where it's clear by 2009 that dubstep is going to be big, big, big. And some people, as this scene is just want to do, some people step back from the brink and others go full big room all the way. And some people like Code 9 and Scream, who were in dubstep from the beginning, pull back. And that totally makes sense. It was an underground scene to begin with, and then becomes this possibly the most overblown scene since grunge.
The explosion that happens is both the best and worst thing to ever happen to electronic dance music, because all of a sudden you have all this attention and you have all this possibility for these great hits and adulation and fame and riches and everything else like that. But at the same time, there's this commercial this commercial influence to dumb all the music down, make it bigger, make it simpler, put a big hook in it, get Rihanna on the lyrics, just it got very dumb for a big chunk of it. And, a lot of the biggest stuff was the dumbest. So there was, when you look back on all of the really interesting dubstep that was being made from 2003 up to like 2008 versus, when things go fully bro step, there's nothing wrong with bro step. I love my bro step. I love my death step, which is like two to three steps further than bro step. And I love all of the really weird kind of stuff that's come out of, how extreme that the genre went. But, the guys that were making the stuff in 2006, it's not shocking that they were horrified by what this thing was becoming, because it was a total bastardization of what they were working on, which in itself was a bastardization of, original dub reggae. So yeah. The continuation of bastardization down through history.
Yeah, it's just another split, like we saw when Acid House split off into hardcore or intelligent dance music, or you had drum and bass splitting off into intelligent drum and bass, minimal techno. Over and over again, this dynamic happens. But let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk about Skrillex.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And as promised, now is the time when we talk about Skrillex, a.k.a. Sonny Moore. Matos introduces him by way of Craig Coleman, who's an Atlantic Records exec, gives Coleman's bio. Coleman had founded Big Beat Records in 1987 at age 22, sold it to Atlantic in 1991, became an executive in good standing at Atlantic for the next 20 years, but then in 2010 reactivates his Big Beat Records, has a launch party at the Winter Music Conference in Miami, and Sonny Moore, aka Skrillex, is at the bottom of the bill doing his first DJ gig. Sonny had been a singer in the Screamo band from first to last, blew out his voice doing that, so then he, as one does, moves on to bro step. Coleman met him and immediately signed him after listening to what was on his laptop for a couple hours, just gobbled him right up. The My Name is Skrillex EP drops in June 2010. deadmau5 immediately posted it to his Facebook page, and Skrillex instantly becomes the face of dubstep. And what a face it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that My Name is Skrillex is really a fusion of electro and dubstep. And it really sets the tenor for what the festival sound, the hard electronic dance music festival music sound is going to be for the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, people give Skrillex a lot of hate. But it's funny, as soon as the sound that he kind of pioneered in Brostep got tired, he just kept on evolving. And the stuff that he's been doing, even up to now, is really fascinating and well-produced. And I feel like he's trying to be more of a Diplo, where while he has all of this commercial success, well, not even commercial success. Haven't we talked about the fact that no Skrillex album has ever hit platinum?
It's true. It's true. I do believe we've mentioned that. And he's an interesting contrast to deadmau5, who I don't think you could say has prioritized artistic development, or is that unfair?
Well, I mean, deadmau5 is just, it's really, he's an interesting character because he's one of those guys that's a trance dude, and he was put in the progressive house under the label of progressive house just because of the label that he was releasing was releasing nothing but progressive house. So he kind of reformulated trance music for festivals as well. And then he was very smart at teaming up with a number of really good producers and starting to make those really hooky pop songs. But, you know, the thing I appreciate about deadmau5 is that he never sold his sound out. Tiesto, the Tiesto of now who makes EDM music, you couldn't even tell that that's Tiesto. A Tiesto track, you hear it, there's no remaining ounce of Tiesto from the 90s and 2000s when he was a trance god. He sold all that out to get rid of it. While deadmau5 is still deadmau5 from 2006 onwards, all of his stuff still holds on to the essence of who he is, but he will still manage to step into the commercial realm and release a hit that is not only sonically really well put together, but also palatable for the masses.
Nicely said. Nicely said. And then Matos takes us back to Miami. We mentioned it for the Skrillex debut. And he talks about he's comparing the Winter Music Conference, which was, you know, the Business Insider thing. It's doing like 3,700 people by 2010. But the Ultra Music Festival that we talked about last week that sprang up in its wake was more aimed at millennial kids. And by 2010, it's hitting 100,000 visitors for the second year in a row. And then in 2011, Winter Music Conference announces its dates for the next year. Or in 2010, they announced their 2011 dates. They're planning to go 2 weeks earlier than usual, but the Ultra Music Festival stayed put and happened later and expanded to 3 days. Ultra 2011 draws 150,000 people, and by 2012, WMC has to expand to 9 days so that the last three will coincide with the later Ultra, and quote, nobody questioned who'd won. So, and this is kind of a theme in this chapter of the old guard and the dance insiders kind of being just brutally pushed aside by the new kids in their masses.
Yeah, if you weren't willing to roll with what was happening, you were going to be left behind. And that's one thing you got to give to Pascal Rotella and Insomniac, is that they moved forward with the times. They weren't, you know, Pascal was around since like 1993. Doing the old school thing, but he rolled with the times, and he kept up with what the kids were interested in, and it gave them what they wanted. And therefore he's still around today, and he's now probably the most important rave promoter in North America.
Yeah. And Matos talks about how, you know, there's a coalition of forces and he lumps in Cinespace style hard electro. That's Steve Aoki's club in LA. West Coast festival sired rise of dubstep. So dubstep's getting big at these West Coast festivals, the increasingly EDM heavy pop, hip hop, R&B and rock charts, and the clean line womp of younger European producers, which he doesn't mention, but I assume he's talking about people like Avicii and Calvin Harris.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's so many guys that could apply to, but yeah, I think probably it's safe to say.
Okay. And then the increasing self-marginalization of EDM's artier wing. So yeah, stuff like minimal house and micro house and, you know, all the artsy fartsy stuff is painting itself into a corner happily while everybody else gets on with the big parties. And then he talks about how EDM replaced rave and the terminology of promoters. And that's just something they learned the hard way, is that raves was associated with arrests, the DEA, overdoses, ambulances, stuff like that. EDM is this new festivals and shiny and bright and money and healthy and safe.
So yeah, it didn't have 25 years of negative connotation attached to it. So it was definitely time for a rebrand, and it was very smart of the people to do it. When I was throwing raves, we never said the word rave when we were talking to a venue owner or to basically anybody in a position of authority. You never said the word rave. It was an all night non-alcoholic dance party. Sometimes for youth. Sometimes you mention the youth.
And so then he talks about Las Vegas, and he talks about how there had sort of been an organic dance scene in the 90s, but it was relatively feeble. It choked on itself by 1996, going out, as Matos says, in the usual way, because promoters were calling the cops on each other. Like 1996 Desert Moves event only drew a couple thousand people. And Vegas natives Crystal Method, who we've mentioned in a few previous episodes, they got nowhere until they left Vegas for LA and then got places. But by the early 2000s, like, the Palms Hotel featured Paul Oakenfold. That was a turning point for mainstream acceptance of EDM. That was in 2008 in Vegas. And by 2011, 9/10 of America's top grossing clubs were in Vegas. Afrojack's got a residency at the Wynn, and EDM DJs are being booked at the Cosmopolitan. So Vegas, very capitalistic city, and they get it. And meanwhile, the last Electric Daisy Carnival in LA happened at the LA Coliseum in 2010, and a young girl, Sasha Rodriguez, unfortunately died of, I guess, dehydration and overexertion from an overdose. And so they had 180,000 people over 2 days, but LA County didn't want any part of it. All they saw was the negative aspect, and LA's loss is Vegas's gain, because Rotella moves EDC to Las Vegas, and the rest is history, frankly. There hadn't been a party this big in American history. That's pretty big doings.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with LA is that they never really wanted, no one in the government wanted to be in with these guys having anything to do with the rave stuff. So Rotella was being forced to, like, basically, you know, bend over backwards for every event to try and keep everything rolling. There was accusations that he was paying off cops, accusations that he was paying off the LA Coliseum. And, you know, the truth of the matter was, it's like, he's not doing anything wrong. It's everybody on the other side demanding these kickbacks, and he's just accommodating what he has to do in order to make these events happen. But finally, he gets pushed out of LA. They didn't want him to begin with. After this death, he was persona non grata. So he moves to Las Vegas, and they welcome him with open arms. And all of a sudden, he's got not only the support of the city, but of the venue. And the cops are saying, you know what, this is no different than any other roving tour event, and we're going to treat it like that. So all of a sudden they have partners, as opposed to somebody that's potentially going to come in and wreck their whole event at any given time. And you know, we've talked about the history of rave and why it didn't manage to survive for so many decades, and it's because the government just kept on coming in and messing everything up and stepping all over any promoter who had a tiny amount of success. And to have a base in Las Vegas where that wasn't the case anymore, once they were able to get over the old style, the old stuffy Las Vegas is a place for degenerate gamblers, back when degenerate gambling wasn't cool, then all of a sudden, it was game on. It was a whole new era.
Yep. And let's hear one more track. This is DEADMAU5, Move For Me. And that was DEADMAU5, Move For Me. Do we need to explain this?
I can give it a little explain. Just giving you that DEADMAU5 sound and the commercial sound that he kind of embraced from time to time. He co-wrote that with Cascade, who has the opening quote in this chapter about how Winter Music Conference is dead. Ultra, long live Ultra. And he calls it basically a Guida Brofest. And I'm like, Cascade, man, like, this is your fault. So, you know, like, even the people in the middle of the maelstrom causing all of this chaos and churn are sometimes looking at what they've done and they're going, oh my God.
Yeah, and there's a lot to question because the success is going to be massive. 230,000 fans over 3 days at the first electric Daisy Carnival in Vegas, sold out 6 weeks in advance. Tickets are $100 to $500, which seems cheap now, but at the time was really steep. Six stages. Crystal Method came back, homecoming, to open up Friday evening, and we're stoked, even though that's not the sweetest gig. There's no Derek May style pouting about it. They are just happy to be on the bill. And here's an interesting sentence. I wanted to ask you what you think Matos means here. He said, EDC Vegas was like EDM as a whole, was both the inverse and the net result of Electro Clash's gleeful fuck you to dance music orthodoxy and to the mashup becoming the DJ's secret weapon. What does that mean, both the inverse and the net result?
I guess it's what happens when you stop taking dance music so seriously and just enjoy it for quote unquote what it is. It allows you to kind of just give lowest denominator drops and, you know, throw in some lyrics from Gwen Stefani or Red Hot Chili Peppers and the people eat it up. So it's very much just a repudiation of the idea that this music has to come from somewhere and mean something and follow these rules of the grandfathers of yesterday. And now it's turned into full on throw a cake in my face, thrash music, you know, and there's a lot of people enjoyed that. And I enjoyed a lot of the stuff that was coming out at this point in time. But yeah, it was definitely a big difference from, you know, a couple of years ago when people were saying the house was a soul thing. It was, you know, it was a very personal thing. It's a ritual.
Yep. And now it's basically top 40 or 80s AOR having its revenge. And he talks about how the DJs at Electric Daisy Carnival had effectively had a top 40 and that the same tracks are getting dropped in set after set. Adele's Rolling in the Deep, which also serves as a Molly joke. Rolling, get it? Ha ha. Pitbull and Afrojax. We already mentioned Give You Everything with Neo and Nair. LMFAO's Party Rock Anthem, a staple, but also had these rock classics like you mentioned, Red Hot Chili Peppers Outside from the year 2000, White Stripes Seven Nation Army, Blur Song 2, and Matos says this was a whole new underground, an unblinking ritualistic celebration of music you'd been able to just turn on the radio and hear every single day for decades. This was something that had gone on for years, but only now was non-niche media paying attention, and the EDM market in the US is now the number one market globally because it's blown up, and also the European market has kind of tanked. So, you know, it's the good with the bad. He's also got a line about some of this stuff is so poppy it would give Brian Adams insulin shock. So, yeah, it's just the classic what happens when you win. You know, just like rock and roll in the 60s wins at Woodstock and or rock wins. And by the late 70s, you've got Boston and Air Supply both under the umbrella of rock. And so EDM wins. And the big prize is, you know, Adele's Rolling.
The loss of your soul. That was, everybody was just afraid of the fact that we were going to lose our soul in the process because so many new people are coming in. And the demand for this big room EDM, this soulless, simplistic pop-oriented dance music, threatened to just push everything else completely to the side and maybe ruin it. So the big question was: is this gonna just, are all these people gonna come in, completely change the entire scene around, and then find something new and shiny in a year or two, walk away, and the entire scene's gonna collapse? And fortunately, there's been more of a everything's kind of resettled into a new homeostasis where you've got the ridiculous, super poppy, big artists, but then you've got guys like all the Dirty Bird guys are still around doing a bunch of really interesting kind of house and techno stuff. And they're appreciated, if not as much as the David Guettas and the Tiestos, they're still headlining you know, the second stage or whatever else like that. And there's still a lot of really good, deep, interesting, and well-produced music being made on top of just the, you know, the color by number EDM stuff that might be going on at Electric Daisy Carnival on the main stage.
And speaking of Electric Daisy Carnival, the main stage, and DJ Tiesto, he was there, played Kinetic Field Friday night, had the Flaming Lotus Girls accompanying or performing while he was playing. And then Flash by Green Velvet is one of the staples of his set, the Nicky Romano remix, which was new at the time. And it's interesting that Matos says that Flash was the one older dance track to achieve the ubiquity of Other Side, the Red Hot Chili Peppers song we just mentioned, that wasn't by Daft Punk, whose Discovery album had become EDM Sgt. Pepper's. So I find it pretty satisfying. If one house track is going to make it through to the new generation, that it be Green Velvet, my favorite guy.
Yeah, and maybe it wasn't the only one. Like anybody who's been in the scene for long enough knows that there's kind of like a 50-track classics box that samples can be lifted out of and put into tracks, and they're just timeless, and they just keep on getting rebuilt and reused and resampled and appearing in all sorts of interesting spots. But it is cool that Flash, being such a dirty, grimy track, gets picked up and survives and gets put into this new commercial prism, and it still works.
Yep. And speaking of still working, Richie Hawtin, of course, was at EDC. He performed two times, once as Plastic Man at the Cosmic Meadow on Friday night, and then on Saturday night at the Circuit Grounds doing his DJ act. We talked about last week his Mutech 2004 attempt at a Daft Punk style multimedia extravaganza had kind of flopped and wasn't technically ready. But by 2011, it's absolutely a well-oiled machine. Plastic Man goes off without a hitch. And just in time for Plastic Man's box set, which had just been re-released, his catalog's coming back out there, also a best of CD. And then Mato says, the next several years of Houghton's career amounted to an extended PR campaign dedicated to reaching the younger, heedless, pop-leaning EDM crowd from the more entrenched underground. So Houghton's basically having to tell these kids, hey, listen to me. I'm the old guy that matters. But also,
well, not just him. He was also very much pushing everybody else. Like he was very much about trying to like teach the history, so that again, that everybody was waiting for the great collapse, and the big hope was that we could teach enough of these kids about what was going on outside of the bright lights of the Speedway, and show them that there is an underground that's worth checking out. There's history that's worth checking out. And, you need proselytizers like that. And it's cool that he was doing it, even as he was getting kind of crapped on for, you know, just being Plastic Man.
Yep. And also by 2008, he's a very successful businessman. He had sold Final Scratch to Native Instruments, a Beatport, which he'd started with John Acquaviva, very successful. So all's well in Richie Hawtin land. Then we take a little detour. Somehow we're talking about Coachella 2009 and Steve Aoki, who had a need to put on a, quote, damn show. And this is when he develops his trademark of throwing cake at the audience.
Yeah, just one of the many things he was up to. He kind of describes the thought process, if you can call it that, of what they ended up doing, where he was like, okay, well, get me some super soakers, get me like a raft, get me like a whole bunch of things. He's taking everything that he's ever seen at a punk and rock show over his last 15 years, and he's saying, okay, let's gather all these things and let's try it out. He's A/B testing the audience to see what works, and somehow the cake stuck.
It's a good thing he wasn't a big Gallagher fan, or we would have watermelons being smashed on the crowd. But with the crowds of the size he's playing, you can only throw so much cake, so it's not that big of a menace. But let's hear our last track, and this is David Guetta featuring Akon, Sexy Bitch. And that was Sexy Bitch by David Guetta featuring the R&B producer Akon. Why'd we pick this one?
It's just the bastard child of pop music and dance music distilled down into its worst tendencies.
There you go. There you go. And Matos actually shouts out Swedish House Mafia as the ones that could give Peter Cetera insulin shock. That he said they exemplified the trend of EDM's blended out, please everyone aspect. But David Guetta is right in there with Swedish House Mafia, just tramping it up with hits like Sexy Bitch. And as you mentioned earlier, he's got a bit from the record company, which was just scratching their heads at what to do with David Guetta as an album artist. But then when he packaged this stuff for him, they realized, oh, you're a hit single artist. And
it's funny, this is kind of like, I remember episodes and episodes back, we talked about how, you know, live PAs would just play one track and then it would end and then start their next track. And then someone got the bright idea to like mix all the tracks together. And it was a revelation. And it's one of those basic things. This is a similar basic revelation that should have been obvious that, oh, you know, it's not always the singles sell the album. Sometimes it's just the singles sell the singles. And like, these are not album artists. Stop trying to make them album artists. Like you're stuck in this like 70s mentality where you're trying to make a Dark Side of the Moon. And meanwhile, you should just be releasing Sexy Bitch for people for a dollar and selling the ringtone.
Yeah. I mean, the KLF wrote a book about it in the early 90s. So it shouldn't be, that mysterious, but they finally figured it out. This is how we can get EDM on the American pop charts. And then he starts talking about Sidney Samson, whose Dirty Dutch Style is a hit. And then his set slam banged with far more finesse than his colleagues. But he says Samson wasn't oppositional. He wasn't a refusal. It was an affirmation of the status quo, as was Electric Daisy Carnival and EDM itself, for a generation for whom house music has been lingua franca since birth. So it's one of these things. By the time EDM won commercially, it was more of a coronation than a confrontation. It was just the rightful king sort of taking the throne by this.
Yeah, and anybody could come and have a part in it. You only had to sell out a little bit. But they could, if you just had a couple of those things. They had an interesting story about how the Basement Jacks showed up and they were scrambling to try and figure out what they could play that would be hard enough to please this audience that was going off to some of these ridiculous EDM bangers. And it's just, that's kind of what people ended up having to do. They had to play ball a bit. They had to meet the intensity of what these guys were playing, which is, you know, that's why it was called Big Room, is because this is music for a big room. It doesn't need to be subtle. It needs to be loud and it needs to have big drops. And if you got a big drop, you can come and you can play for these people too, but you gotta sell your soul a little bit and join, take some of those EDM elements and bring them into yourself and hope that you don't lose yourself in the process.
Yeah, and this is very much analogous to like rock's move into stadiums in the early 70s, when suddenly you had these barbarians at the gates like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath that were sort of an affront to the delicate sensibilities of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane and 60s artists that had dominated previously. Once you're playing to these massive venues, you got to make the big gestures and, you know, it's all Al Jolson, baby. You ain't seen nothing yet. None of this Bing Crosby subtlety and whispering into the microphone. This is big house music, big room music. Got to be big, big gestures. And Skrillex, of course, is perfect for this. He's anointed the king of dubstep at his 3 a.m. set Saturday at Neon Garden. But the audience was not the Burning Man Bass Nectar crew, but rather their younger siblings. And this difference between Bass Nectar and Skrillex is pretty fascinating to me. It's kind of just the slightly underground version that then is just codified into perfect hard rock, essentially, for a whole new generation. And it's massive.
Yeah, it's very interesting how like certain things get deemed just not a part of the larger scene, and how Skrillex kind of gets left out of the UK dubstep story, and he kind of gets pushed out of the bass scene as well. But again, he went off and he's making like really interesting house and electro stuff and all kind of mixed in with pop and stuff. So he doesn't care. He doesn't need it. He's still doing fine.
Yeah, no worries, no tears for Skrillex. And then Matos ends the chapter with a couple of anecdotes. He talks about Kevin Kerslake's Electric Daisy Carnival Experience documentary, which premiered in Hollywood on July 27th of 2011 or 2012?
2011, anyway, I think.
Of 2011. And it's supposed to be just a low-key movie documentary debut, but they put out word he was going to DJ, and suddenly 10,000 people showed up to see the set, and turns into a police riot and ends up with 500 screenings canceled. So the curse of Rave's ability to draw more attention than it needs to itself is still ongoing.
And yeah, we still got that snafu in our blood.
Yep. And so I mean to track down this fest. Have you seen the Electric Daisy Carnival Experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty free form. It's like just a whole lot of footage from inside the party, a couple people talking about stuff, some sets. It's definitely it's an interesting watch. It's what you would kind of imagine if you showed up at the festival and just kind of wandered through it for 2 hours. It's very free form, but it gives you like in another 20 or 30 years, it's going to be fascinating because like right now it's still pretty representative of what you'd see now at Electric Daisy Carnival. But it's kind of like when we went back and we watched that Disco Donnie documentary, and that was like mid 90s rave, and it was very different and weird. So it's a very good time capsule for what like 2009 Electric Daisy Carnival raving looked like.
And then Matos ends the chapter by mentioning Disco Donnie and how he had been a partner of Pasquale Rotella at Electric Daisy Carnival, but they split after 2010 and Rotella sells out to Live Nation in 2011. So the machine swallows it up. As soon as it's massively successful, the corporate behemoth is there. And so, Ryan, we are coming to our last chapter. Next week is our last chapter, and we'll be talking about the Random Access Memories event in Los Angeles, California, January 26, 2014. So for Ryan Harkness, I'm Nate Wilcox, and we're still talking about The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America by Michelangelo Matos.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Ryan and Nate finish the book with a look at Random Access Memories from 2014. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.